As the opioid crisis continues, pain management remains critical for a patient's quality of life. Dr. David Copenhaver and Dr. Amy Mullen from UC Davis Health join us to share their thoughts on the past, present, and future of pain management. Next on Studio Sacramento.
At Five Star Bank, we create thoughtful solutions to help the Capital Region thrive, from economic development and education to public health and safety, issues that are vitally important to Sacramento's prosperity. We're proud to be part of the conversation and hope you'll join in.
This Studio Sacramento episode is supported by UC Davis Health, where doctors, nurses, researchers, and staff share a passion for advancing health. Learn more about their latest medical innovations at health.ucdavis.edu.
Dr. Copenhaver, what is it about opioids that has led them to be the first line of defense in pain management for most of us?
It's a good question, Scott. I mean, I think it's one that has to take us back a number of years. Opium in all of its forms has been around for eons. As we kind of struggled out of the cave and were chewing on plant products to provide pain relief, analgesia, it was found that the poppy seeds of the opium provided that relief. The idea of why that has become the mainstay is really a progression of events. If I summarize and gave you the executive summary, in the late 70s, early 80s, the idea there was a push by the World Health Organization to understand cancer pain. And there was an analgesic ladder. Opioids were the very last tier of that ladder. But there was a public health crisis to understand cancer as it's associated with its pain and its effect on quality of life. It was a public health right that patients should receive pain relief and pushed throughout the globe. So there was great success in understanding that analgesic ladder. Opioids in all of their forms don't really serve any, there's no real diagnosis. They can treat many different types of pain, whether a fracture or...
Wait a minute, when you say that there's no real diagnosis, so you're saying that someone feels pain and you just throw an opioid at them?
I think
that's... I'm not trying to be flip, but seriously.
No, absolutely. This was the principle, is the idea that opioids were a catch-all type of therapy. The therapy that could be used for a elective appendectomy just as easily as someone fell off a ladder and has a femur fracture. The sophistication of knowing what's causing the pain is left out of the picture. But the ease of the therapy to treat the pain phenomenon, never mind the diagnosis, was ever present. So from this cancer pain experience, patients were offered this because the idea was we did pretty well with cancer-related pain, although there's information that would help us highlight that a little bit. But non-cancer pain was transitioned to suggest, well, if it worked well in that sphere, cancer-related pain, perhaps it works for non-cancer
pain. Well, Dr. Mullen, you're an ER physician.
Yep.
And, you know, the one of the sayings is treat them and street them.
Yes.
When someone presents in the ER and they're facing the myriad of conditions that people come to the ER for, how is it that you and your colleagues utilize opioids?
And I think that's definitely evolved. As we've learned more about the risks of opiate therapy, we've kind of started to understand like how to risk stratify patients. Like, what are the risks that you might have untreated pain when you go home versus what are the very real risks associated with opiates in terms of their long-term and short-term side effects? And so I think we have to start thinking in terms of risk-benefit on pain management. I also think, you know, there is some pressure. You come to the emergency department with an acutely painful condition and you sit through the waiting room and you go through all the trouble and drama of coming to an ER. And then if I tell you what you really need is something you can get over the counter, acetaminophen or ibuprofen,
aspirin.
And you will probably feel like, well, what good were you? And so to some extent, writing a prescription for an opiate kind of validates that visit. And for years, we were told that we were under-treating pain and that we were under-recognizing pain and that we were bad
at it. Based on what?
So there was a lot of studies showing that opiates were prescribed less for women. Opiates were prescribed less for children. Opiates were prescribed less for minorities. And so based on that data, they extrapolated and said, well, if you are under-treating pain in these populations, and the part of that message was, if you are a compassionate doctor and if you are a respectful doctor, you will treat pain. And that led us to kind of overcompensate and, I think, over-treat pain.
Now, one of the things in your ER is you actually have patients who present who are either addicted or maybe having an overdosing episode or mm-hmm. something like that. You all at UC Davis are doing some interesting things on, catching that and confronting that. What are those?
Yeah, so we've actually started to look at addiction as a disease. And for opiate addiction, this is a treatable disease. And I'm seeing patients on the other end.
It's treatable.
It is.
In the popular media, it's a death sentence.
You know, I have a lot of arguments with the media, because if you look at the media, there's a lot of sensational stories about people dying in the streets, overdose, heroin use, and it's great to show these stories of just the death and destruction that follows opiate addiction. But this is a treatable illness. This is not a death sentence. And it is treatable. There's medications that actually can treat and help manage opiate use disorder. It's an oral medication. I can see someone in the ER who has been using heroin, and I can treat their withdrawal, and we can stabilize them with an oral medication and then refer them to outpatient treatment. It's an easy visit. It's an easy, treatable problem.
And is this the program that you all
Yes. So in our emergency department, we treat addiction like we treat diabetes, asthma. So if someone comes in and they have addiction, then we try and stabilize them and get them into treatment. And so I think changing the mindset of someone has an addiction and it's a moral failing and it's a death sentence to you have a treatable medical disease, I think is really important. And I think that's an important message that we want to get out there. And I'm encouraging more of my colleagues to take that mindset and to start treating patients with addiction.
Dr. Copenhaver, kind of take us back to the beginning. You gave us this history on where the use of opioids really got their popularity. But how did we get into this crisis?
No, I think it's really a position of where the risks of opioids were misconstrued as safe. And it came from this history of treating cancer-related pain and having somewhat some success, because it's the mainstay for many cancer-related, tumor burden-related pain concerns. Opioids are certainly effective. There's almost seems to be this moratorium on opioids, and that they're a demonically possessed therapy, and that we need to avoid that at all costs. There are individuals who do well with opioid therapy.
I want to ask both of you this. Hold your point. But do you think that the pendulum is swinging too far? Because as Dr. Milan said, it's almost like opioids are considered to be these demonic agents that are uniformly going right. to destroy lives.
I would suggest that the pendulum has swung to a certain degree. However, it's a healthy dose of skepticism to realize where the tool is useful. So in the early 90s, you had the first case actually in California, the Bergman versus Chin case. A patient passed in a skilled nursing facility, and the physician was sued, in this case, for the suggestion for the under-treatment of pain. But the patient was actually being treated for pain. In that case, it was one under the elder abuse statute, and it was about a $1.5 million payout. It changed the societal kind of landscape understanding how we treat patients in pain in California. Most physicians would say, I'm a compassionate physician. It's certainly not going to be me that's sued in this setting. If we fast forward just about 5 years later in 2000, right at that blip, that asymptote on the graph, pain became the fifth vital sign, and hospitals were asked to track it, to in a sense, kind of monitor it. But there was very little education and pre-licensure education in terms of medical school.
How much training?
We were also lied to. I mean, we can't forget about the fact that we were lied to by drug companies very specifically on the long-term effects. There was plenty of studies out there showing that if you took OxyContin because you were in pain, you could not become addicted to it. And that OxyContin was not addictive, it was a long-acting drug, and that simply was not true.
You're kidding.
It was not true.
I would say, and I mean, I think that there, whatever the intent and motives, the suggestion that the safety, the risks of opioid therapy are clearly known, the benefits, unclear. So if the risks are substantially known, it means that that risk-benefit analysis has to be applied to each patient. And that's where you risk stratify patients. What we've learned from this experience of just tracking pain is that hospitals were held to task, that if your pain scores weren't within an appropriate range, there was actual repercussions in some way.
That's where that whole thing in the doctor's office where someone's smiling the smiley face all the way to crying came in?
Exactly. The Wong Baker faces scale. There's some nice episodes on the TV show Scrubs where they put different pictures of different faces up to individuals to check how their pain is. But it's really the tracking, but without any preparation for educating on what we're tracking. So in the end, we were left with assessing pain, or at least evaluating and tracking it, with no real understanding of how to treat it.
Let me ask a question. Do physicians in general in medical school get enough training on pain management?
It is part of medical school. I think the challenge is there's the breadth of medicine, and then everyone kind of specializes. Well, pain crosses every specialty, but in a different way. So for me, I treat acute pain, and you're treating long-term pain. And so the education that he has and the expertise that you have if you are treating long-term pain, sort of different than my acute pain experience. For me, what I'm best at is you broke your arm, you broke your ankle, you have a toothache. How can I best manage that this week? I'm an ER doctor, I think in very short term. I think about, your week-long experience versus your long-term experience. And for me, we have to start changing. If I start this opiate for your toothache today, I'm going to make you feel better today. And you're going to be happy today, and you're going to like me, and you're going to think that I did a good job. But I might have exposed you with your family history or whatever biochemistry or social situation to a highly addictive substance for the first time. And I might be the first person that exposes you to that opiate that does lead you to a serious medical disease, which is addiction. And so I need to start thinking, what is your risk of addiction? And what is your long-term outcome if I start you on that today?
Same question to you, Dr. Copenhaver. Yeah, is there enough education?
I would say sadly, no. I'm a proud product of the University of California, and I could say that we are struggling to change curricula as we speak to meet what are the concerns of a huge gap. I agree that pain in general as a study is an orphan. It doesn't have a home. So it's part of every major discipline, but doesn't have its own home. So our effort in a pain division is typically a multidisciplinary effort. But that understanding alone is that typically in my experience, I'm not sure for Amy's, I learned about prescribing opioid therapy as an intern on the job, actually, with my first prescription in a senior resident.
So how many hours would you say you spent?
In medical school, I would say formally, specifically on pain training, it was on molecular components of pain, and it was about approximately 1 hour. 1 4 years.
Well, hour?
The state of California requires 12 hours to get a medical license.
So in I would say that the component that people have talked about is in our veterinary schools, there's substantially more education on pain management.
In our veterinary schools, there's more education than for human beings.
I would suffice to say yes, and I would also there's many articles that support that. I would also tell you that when you look at the U.S. medical licensing exam, we just did a nice review of the USMLE. This is the medical licensing exam required for pre-licensure graduates to become licensed. Pain actually showed up on the exam. And it's typically in the phenomenon of acute pain, recognizing pain, but actually the sophisticated understanding of managing pain, not at all present. Assessing and evaluating, or even the social context of the pain, which are all incredibly important, not present on the exam. I could say that the deficiency in learning about pain in and of itself as a phenomenon is one of the root causes for where we are today.
You know, I'm going to say you're a pain specialist. So that is sort of everything that you do. And medical education doesn't stop with medical school. You learn about prescribing pain and treating pain during residency, which is part of our education. So I don't think there's only 1 hour in medical school. And I don't think if you talk about medical education, you can stop with medical school, because most of us actually learn how we practice during residency. So I think if you're not including education in residency and then ongoing training for continuing medical education, you're, of course, underestimating the amount people learn how to treat pain in medical school, because medical school is not really medical training. We learn that in residency. So I don't know the studies because it's not entirely my specialty, but we spend a lot of time in my residence talking about how to treat pain. And now, because they're my residents, they're learning a lot about how to treat addiction. And so I think that, yes, the pendulum is swinging. Yes, we've learned so much in the past several years about the risks of opiate therapy and how we can do a better job of addressing underlying treatment. But to talk about 1 hour in medical school, I think is kind of underestimating the breadth of what people learn during their training programs.
Well, where this leads me to is, whether it's 1 hour or 12 hours, it almost appears that there's a strange disconnect between how many people present with pain, whether it's in an ER setting, whether it's in an ongoing setting, and what the state of the treatment modes are that are available. Because if you know, the roots are morphine, which goes back thousands of years, and we're still riding the morphine horse with all of the, supposedly the whiz-bang technology that's happening in healthcare, why are we still riding a thousand-year horse?
Yeah, and I hear what you're saying. And I don't think the answer is to say more education, because certainly the education that we got before pushing morphine and pushing opiates and focused on under-treating and under-recognizing pain got us to where we are. So you need the right type of education, you need the right content, and I think that does need to be specific to practice patterns. So for me, and in emergency medicine, we need to learn more about treating acute pain, doing more regional anesthetics, and using nerve blocks to do a better job of blocking pain receptors. And you're right. I mean, the opiates are an incredibly powerful medication. They interact with your brain in an incredibly powerful way to block your sensation to pain. They do it in a broad sense, and they're incredibly effective. So the basis of this is, you know, as physicians, we see people suffering. And it's really hard when you see someone suffering to have something that you know will relieve that suffering. It's really hard if you went into medicine and you want to do that to relieve suffering, to know that I can do that in a short-term way and I can make you feel better. And to hold back on that because of long-term risks is hard. And that's the education that you need, is how do I have that conversation with my patients? How do I educate you on the risks benefits so you don't walk away thinking, you know, that doctor didn't care about me, and they don't understand my suffering, and they're a bad doctor. And so how do I communicate to you in a way that is caring and empathetic that these other options are probably better for your long-term health? And that's the education I need, not you need to use more opiates or you're under-treating pain, but how do I have that conversation so that you feel that we're taking care of you in the best possible way? Because I think that's what most of us want to do.
It's interesting that you say that because, you know, many times that's more of a bedside manner conversation than a strictly science conversation,
yeah.
Even though it might lead to better outcomes.
I would say it's actually, there's science and technique behind that. So partly it's how we talk to patients in pain. And there's a whole strategy of motivational interviewing, how to listen, how to formulate a treatment plan that's customized based on the patient's responses. And then, of course, what Amy's suggesting is risk stratifying patients. What we didn't realize in the past is those patients with untreated psychiatric comorbid disease, patients with a history of addiction, family history of addiction, are more at risk. Sounds like a no-brainer, but these were components that just weren't assessed, largely because of the unique capacity of what opioids have to offer. There was a fabulous Forbes article that described, just as I mentioned, the requirement as pain as the fifth vital sign and hospitals being held to task for monitoring the pain score, never mind instruction, which I feel is tremendously lacking on how to treat pain. The idea that your satisfaction, patient satisfaction scores, help guide the industry. That is the medical industrial complex of what is health. And there's a great Forbes article describing an ER physician that improved their patient satisfaction with prescribing more opioid. It gives the wrong message, and it's completely to the point that we're describing, that I think that the therapy was misconstrued as safe. The long-term risks weren't played out, and now they have. Like I said, there's many different risks besides just addiction. So we're left with understanding what are the other opioid-sparing strategies. And folks that are pain specialists, physicians come from many different backgrounds. So in my case, I'm an anesthesiologist, so we treat acute pain postoperatively, and we have focused on chronic pain. But we also have physiatrists, neurosurgeons that come through, as well as psychiatrists, all that become board
certified. And this is at the center?
At the center, and folks that are actually trained with us and then become board certified in pain management. So I think each of them bring different things to bear on understanding pain as a phenomenon. I think one thing that we haven't talked about in this conversation is what is the definition of pain? And what has been described as the definition of pain since the 70s is really from the International Association for the Study of Pain. And it says that pain is an unpleasant emotional or sensory response actually described in terms of actual or potential tissue damage. And I'll italicize and underline the potential. And then, of course, they have the legalese, or described in terms of such damage at the end of the definition. This comes to bear in understanding pain from a broad and kind of a robust perspective. I have a colleague at UCSF that was asking me about tinnitus, or tinnitus, depending on what part of the country you're from, and the suggestion that ringing in the ears, so profound, creates an unpleasant emotional experience, so profound that it's unclear if it's potential or is it actual tissue damage that can provoke suicide.
That actually speaks to the whole issue of pain and whether or not it actually has a effect on quality of life and health outcomes. Does it?
Absolutely. Yeah. But so does excessive opiate use.
Right.
You know, we know that opiate use disorder also causes social isolation and has lots of negative consequences in terms of quality of life. Having chronic, untreated, debilitating, bone-crushing pain also impacts your quality of life. And how we thread that needle and improve someone's quality of life and find the spot where you're balancing the risks and benefits and really getting that person to be as functional as possible, That's the challenge. And I think that's the challenge that we're facing right now as we've learned more about the risks, is not to leave someone in bone-crushing, debilitating pain.
So for the folks that are joining us, give us some advice if we or a loved one are facing pain, whether it's in the ER setting or more of the long-term setting. What question should we be asking of our clinician, one, in terms of how she or he is going to treat us, and two, how to assess whether or not they actually have the right information to be able to give us the most effective treatment to deal with our issue?
I think there's two things that I would like people to know, and one of them is selfish. And the first one is, I think that people need to kind of have reasonable expectations. If you just broke your leg, I'm not going to get you to zero. I can't get you to zero. It's not healthy for you if I get you to zero, but I do need you to be able to go home and sleep at night. And so to some extent, to recognize if you've just had a painful injury, I can't get you to pain-free, but we can get you to comfortable where you can sleep.
And that should be the expectation.
And that needs to be the expectation.
All right.
I think one other thing I want to mention, I think patients do need to have a realistic conversation with their doctor about, you know, what are the risks of the therapy you're prescribing, and what should my expectations be? So if I have an opiate, how long should I use it? When should I stop using it? When should I start using it? And, you know, and at what point do I need to taper off?
Give me one question for us to ask our clinician.
The number one question is, what's causing my pain?
And we will leave it there. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's our show. Thanks to our guests, and thanks to you for watching Studio Sacramento. I'm Scott Syfax. See you next time right here on KVIE.
Thank you for listening to Studio Sacramento from KVIE Public Television. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes to help others find it.
At Five Star Bank, we create thoughtful solutions to help the Capital Region thrive, from economic development and education to public health and safety, issues that are vitally important to Sacramento's prosperity. We're proud to be part of the conversation and hope you'll join in.
This Studio Sacramento episode is supported by UC Davis Health, where doctors, nurses, researchers, and staff share a passion for advancing health. Learn more about their latest medical innovations at health.ucdavis.edu.
All episodes of Studio Sacramento, along with other KVIE programs, are available to watch online at kvie.org/video.